Hi, and welcome to episode 60 of Major Visions. I'm Jeff Atkins from Virginia Commonwealth University, and on this episode of the show, I am joined by Dr. Ryan Emanuel from North Carolina State University. I'm really grateful that Ryan was able to join us on the show. And also remember, you can follow us on Twitter at @major_revisions. You can join us on the web at majorrevisionsshow.com, and you can send us an email at majorrevisionsshow@gmail.com. So, hey, thanks for tuning in and listen to the show. Joining me today is a special guest, Ryan Emanuel, the Associate Professor in the Department of Forestry and Environmental Resources and the Center for Geospatial Analytics at North Carolina State University. Ryan, thank you so much for coming onto the podcast.
Thanks, Jeff. I'm excited to be here.
So do you mind giving us a, because you're obviously going to do a better job of it than I would, kind of an introduction to your research for those who are not as familiar as they should be?
Sure. Yeah, I am principally a hydrologist, and I will often introduce myself as such in scientific company. But in the broader world, I'm known as an environmental scientist, and that stems from my background. I was trained at the University of Virginia in the environmental sciences, where we learn ecology, atmospheric science, geoscience, and hydrology. But most of my work focuses on hydrology, and I do a lot of work at the intersection of water and terrestrial ecosystems. So a lot of my work is also considered eco-hydrology.
Okay, so eco-hydrology has been a thing that's kind of come up on this show before, and I think it's, you know, a lot of our people who listen here are primarily like in ecology. So what is the crossover? What makes ecohydrology ecohydrology? Like, if you had to give that a really good
definition. That is a tricky thing, because ecohydrology as a term has kind of taken on a life of its own. So I think, and I agree, that it can be defined in many different ways, but the way that I came to this field was through a school of thought that's often affiliated with people like Ignacio Rodriguez Iturbe, folks like that, who look at the influence of soil water, or just water in general, on ecosystem processes, namely plant water uptake and carbon assimilation. And so a lot of my early work focused on how the availability of soil moisture influence carbon uptake by different types of terrestrial ecosystems, and how a lack of sufficient soil water introduced stress into plants and caused them to assimilate less CO2. I take a broader view of ecohydrology nowadays. You know, not only do I acknowledge that people are doing really interesting things in other types of ecosystems that could be considered ecohydrology, but I'm also interested in sort of the other direction of that arrow. How do plant processes influence the availability of stream flow, groundwater recharge, and other hydrological fluxes? So to me, ecohydrology is really just the two-way interactions between water and life, and you can define that however you want.
I like the two-way aspect of it. I think that's really cool to think about, instead of it just always being a supply or always being a demand kind of issue, just thinking of it kind of iterative feedback. So question for you that I've been interested in, because a lot of your original work was, or your PhD work was in Montana, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, so looking at like those, like the Stringer Creek watershed work, and looking at, you know, kind of water limitations across landscape and in conjunction with snowmelt. But so you've been in North Carolina for a few years now. How has that changed your research focus in general?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, for the first few years that I was in North Carolina, I continued to invest heavily and work extensively in Montana. And there is some inertia, I guess, associated with a research enterprise once you've invested so much time and infrastructure and intellectual labor into a field site, you just want to keep rolling with it. And so for many years, I continued to work out there in Stringer Creek and focus a lot of my questions on these coupled ecosystem and hydrological processes in snow melt dominated systems. But from the get-go, my objective was to translate some of that insight back to things that are happening in North Carolina. The reason I went to graduate school in the first place was so that I could learn more about water and bring that learning back home in order to help people here in the communities where I grew up and that I care about, to be frank with you. These are the communities that sent me off to college in the first place with the expectation that I would come back someday. So I've worked slowly and in fits and starts to try and bend my research back towards North Carolina. And so that's come in a variety of shapes and forms over the past probably 5 years.
So, because you, so how much? Because you're Lumbee and you're from North Carolina originally, right? Like Robeson County area, or am I
Yep.
making that up?
No,
Okay.
that's right. I wasn't born in Robeson County.
Okay.
That's actually our shibboleth. So I can tell you're not from Robeson County because of the way
I'm
you
not. I'm
speak
from Davidson County, North
today.
Carolina, actually. So about an hour and a half northwest of you.
So that's me. I actually grew up in Charlotte. My parents moved from Robeson County to Charlotte a
Okay.
couple of years before I was born. And so
Okay.
my family grew up there, but I spent a significant portion of my childhood down in Robeson County.
Oh, that's interesting. I've always heard it pronounced Robeson. It's cool to actually hear how it's supposed to be pronounced.
Yeah, there's no robe in Robeson County. Although,
We'll get back to this, but I was doing dialect quizzes like the New York Times ones with my kids this weekend, and it's fascinating because one of my kids was born in North Carolina and one of them was born in Virginia, and even though that 2 or 3 year difference makes a lot, like it shows up in how they talk, and it's fascinating.
interesting.
But so that kind of being native, being indigenous, and you talk about how like you wanted to come back, and that kind of shapes your work as a scientist anyway. How has that tied into both your research now? Like, what has it kind of taken in, because it particularly like into issues of how hydrology and science impact those people in your community?
Yeah, so this is interesting, and I came back to North Carolina after graduate school, thinking that there would be some roadmap for translating the things that I had learned and researched back into insight and useful information for my community. But there really wasn't, or it wasn't something that I was familiar with or trained to do. So like through a lot of trial and error, I realized that what I really need to be doing is just showing up and being present in the community and doing a lot of listening. I can come into a community with preconceived notions about what the important environmental issues are and how hydrological processes might affect people's daily lives. But I have found that a more effective approach is really to sit back and listen to people. And when people know that you're there to engage and to build relationships and to listen, they will open up and share with you, maybe not in the exact language that we're familiar with as academics, but they will explain to you what their concerns are about the environment and how the environment shapes and affects their daily lives. And so through an iterative process in the communities, I've come to maybe formulate some questions that we can address using the tools and techniques of hydrology and ecology and other disciplines. But you know, that's really what it looks like today. And so some of the specifics we've done, we being my lab group, we've done some modeling of stream flow in the Lumbee River under climate change and land use change scenarios. And interestingly, while we were in the middle of that modeling work, Hurricane Matthew arrived and dumped something like 20 inches of rain on the watershed. And that just, yeah, you know, we can talk about the role of antecedent moisture. So how wet is the watershed before a storm comes, and that'll influence what flooding might look like. But once you drop that much water on a watershed, it doesn't matter how wet it was beforehand. You've completely overwhelmed the capacity of the soils and the wetlands and the landscape to mediate flooding, and you're going to cause major problems. And so that's what we saw in 2016 with Hurricane Matthew, and again in 2018 with Hurricane Florence. And in response to both of those hurricanes, my group kind of had to drop what we were doing with the stream flow modeling and completely shift gears and turn into more of a water quality monitoring group. And so we spent a few months after Hurricane Matthew and again after Hurricane Florence collecting water quality samples from different water pools in the Lumbee community initially, and then later after Hurricane Florence, more broadly across eastern North Carolina, you know, for no other reason than to be present in those communities during a time of need. But we also recognized that there was a scientific need there. That was an opportunity to collect some quick response data. We managed to do that, and we collected samples for emerging contaminants. So some of these unregulated compounds, the most famous one is the compound that goes by the name of GenX. I believe it's a PFAS compound that was the result of industrial processes in eastern North Carolina and has since been detected widely across the state now that we know what we're looking for. But we use those same laboratory techniques to do sort of a preliminary screening of all the different types of chemicals that were in surface water and shallow groundwater right after the hurricane. And then we went back and we did similar sort of work after Hurricane Florence. But we've also teamed up with microbiologists and food scientists to study some of the microbiota that are in the streams afterwards. So, you know, that's kind of an example of sort of shifting our research focus in response to very pressing community needs.
Because I think for people who are not familiar with Eastern North Carolina, like Eastern North Carolina has its own kind of, you know, kind of interesting and different history and legacy compared to a lot of the state, particularly when it comes to environmental justice issues. You know, especially if you move down to all the areas where there's lots of hog farms, way down the eastern part of the state, and so like when you're working in these kind of, like you said, you kind of come into this community, like you focus on listening and kind of hearing where people are and moving in that direction. Do you find that there are ways that you have to change how you approach things as a scientist in that way? Or is it just more of just being able to listen and then being able to understand the needs based on that? I don't know if that's a good question. I'm trying to think. Like it's
Yeah, so I would say that the challenge, or one of the challenges, is figuring out how to look inside your scientific toolbox, whether those are computational tools or conceptual tools, you know, other types of tools, and figuring out how to frame community concerns and questions, in ways that allow you to actually answer some of those questions. And so, you know, if you look in your tool bag and you realize this is not something that I'm really equipped to address, if you're invested in those communities and you really want to do something about it, that's when collaborations come into play. And so a lot of my collaborations in recent years have focused on people who have these skills related to microbiology and microbial source tracking and these types of things, or social scientists who really understand how people behave in the wake of natural disasters, or policy experts who understand how environmental permitting processes work and what environmental impact statements are and are not designed to do. So I've learned a lot by teaming up with people who have these different tools and areas of expertise and who are willing to kind of come along for the ride and help help to address some of these issues, not all of them, but some of them. I feel like there was another part of that question as well.
Well, I think so just kind of building on that, what have you found to be the most unique or interesting challenges in kind of doing this cross-disciplinary work? Because, I mean, this obviously, what you do is it's amazing work, but it goes beyond any sense of like what interdisciplinarity is, right? Like, this is kind of like a next level kind of work. So I'm just curious, like, what's the unique challenges that come with that?
Well, let me back up for a minute, because I feel like people may not be familiar with the landscape and the people of Eastern North Carolina. And I know you gave a little introduction to that, but I want to conjure up maybe a little clearer image in people's minds. So this is the Atlantic Coastal Plain. So it's a broad, flat, expansive physiographic region that covers more than a third of North Carolina's landmass and the other states along the eastern seaboard. Over the last 300 or so years, much of that landscape has been transformed into row crop agriculture. And then increasingly, I would say in the past 30 years, an industry of livestock production has grown up in eastern North Carolina. A lot of the landscapes that once supported things like tobacco, cotton, and corn are shifting towards growing animal feed. So corn and soybeans, they're being grown specifically as feed for hogs and poultry. And so I think North Carolina is second only to Iowa in the number of hogs that we grow. But interestingly, our industrial hog farms, so these are the long sheds where the hogs are raised inside before they're sent off to slaughter. These industrial hog operations have been capped in number ever since Hurricane Floyd struck the state in 1999. And in the wake of that hurricane, there was all of this dramatic news coverage of hog carcasses washing down the major waterways of eastern North Carolina and ending up in the estuaries. And we had all kinds of water quality issues associated with that. So in the wake of that, the total number of farms were capped. But what was left uncapped was the number of poultry operations, which are not regulated in the same way that hog operations are for a variety of reasons. And those have really proliferated to the extent that in a paper that I published with Katie Martin and Jim Bose a couple of years ago, we used data from the Riverkeeper group to estimate that there are now twice as many poultry operations as hog operations in North Carolina today. So there's something like 2,000 hog operations, but on the order of 4,000 poultry operations. And they continue to pop up in a handful of counties in eastern North Carolina. And Robeson County, where I'm from, the home of the Lumbee tribe, which is the largest American Indian tribe in the eastern United States. Robeson County is seeing an increasing number of poultry operations over the past few years. I took a field trip last Friday with a group of graduate students from Duke's River Center, and we saw a poultry operation that's under construction right now in Robeson County that just made my jaw drop. They are simultaneously building 48 sheds, and each shed is 600 feet long and something like 60 feet wide. So it's almost like it's like building a small city center all at once, just in the middle of this rural agricultural landscape. And so it's just an immense scale of industrialization that's happening right before our eyes. So that was just one of several major operations that were under construction across the county at the time we were on our field trip. And so I would say, like, one of the big challenges compared to the way hydrologists and ecologists might be used to doing science is set the parameters of what we're studying are constantly changing under our feet. I do work at Coweta Hydrologic Lab, which is this really famous experimental watershed in western North Carolina. And there we can study things that have been left in a so-called reference state for 70 or 80 years. We can go back to the same plots year after year and study things, and we can look at records of stream flow from these unmanaged watersheds that, of course, have environmental change, but it's slow and predictable. And we can go back to these same places year after year and make measurements. And if something else comes along, I can kind of pack up my data sets and set them aside for a few months and then come back and analyze them later. But in Robeson County and other places where the landscape is changing so rapidly, we have these repeated natural disasters. Hurricane Matthew and Hurricane Florence occurred less than 2 years apart. And we also have this intense push towards developing infrastructure like pipelines and gas liquefaction plants and things like this. As soon as you start thinking about maybe doing some field work or modeling or data collection on a topic, it feels like another wave of community concern washes over you. And it can be overwhelming. I can't think of an analogy at any long-term experimental site other than something like a major forest pest outbreak, right? Let's say you were studying pine forests in the Rocky Mountains a decade ago, and all of a sudden mountain pine beetles swept through your study site. You would completely reconfigure your research in order to answer questions about mountain pine beetle. But now imagine, as soon as you had retooled to start doing research on mountain pine beetle, a major wildfire swept through and then burned everything up. And then as soon as you retooled again to think about this major wildfire, yet some other major environmental change would be introduced. And that's what it feels like a little bit when you're working in a place like Robeson County. And it's all the more pressing because this is not some remote experimental station. This is a landscape that is that's tightly connected to large communities of people.
When you're introducing students or, postdocs or even new collaborators who maybe have a more, background, particularly I'm thinking like, students or postdocs, maybe they have a background, in working with reference systems or, working out of textbook type, kind of basis. How do you introduce them or help them get into this dynamic? Because I mean, this is an, it sounds like it's an incredibly dynamic system. like what's even the starting point there?
So you know, the starting point is to start small and look at small plots or cross sections on streams, you know, where we do have some stability and predictability in the system. And, you know, we do things like look at USGS data from established stream gauges in the basin. And one of the cool things about Robeson County and the Lumbee or Lumber River, which flows through the county, is that they have one of the older USGS stream gauges in the region. So we've got a stream gauge on maybe a fourth order section of the Lumbee River that has continuous data going back to 1929. Yeah, so we do have these really rich data sets. And so my students who work in this area will often start by scrutinizing those types of data. I had a master's student recently who was looking at nitrogen processing on the river. So what does nitrate retention look like along different reaches of the Lumbee River? And those USGS data sets were valuable resources in her analysis. You know, but we can start by doing this type of hydrology or stream ecology, biogeochemistry work that you do in other places. It's just that you have to be prepared for contingencies. And for example, in the middle of my students' field work, Hurricane Matthew came and really shook things up. So her thesis evolved from sort of this study of how does nitrogen processing change from season to season to what does this look like before and after a major flood, you know, that really shifts around stream sediments and adds all of this new debris to the stream and makes all of these other changes to the stream environment. So, you know, we can do the types of hydrology and ecology and biogeochemistry work that your listeners are familiar with there. But there are all these other contextual things and all these other contingencies that come in and complicate the bigger questions beyond just the scientific hypotheses and questions that we might ask for an individual study. What I really think we need to do is zoom out and put together a sort of a systems level conceptual diagram of what environmental change looks like in this system. That might allow us to form some bigger scientific questions about the change itself.
Do you think that this is in a way what the future of environmental science looks like, since we live in a world of climate change and we live in a world where anthropogenic impacts are increasingly noticeable, even for those who aren't paying attention? Like, they're just obvious at this point. Is this, do you think, or do you have any sense, or how do you feel, really, I guess, about, you know, that moving forward? Is this how we should approach science more generally? Like, obviously building from, you know, the basic fundamentals, but being increasingly aware of, you know, the human's role in the environment, and also, you know, mitigated, or, you know, aspects of climate change and natural disasters and increasing disturbance.
That's going to be an important shift for some of us. There is absolutely a role for continued fundamental research in hydrology and in other fields, right? We absolutely need to continue this work into basic environmental processes and gaining those mechanistic understandings of systems. That work has to continue. People who do that work will definitely have to acknowledge some of these broader themes of environmental change. I mean, that's been going on for a long time. Most implication sections are sort of wrapped in that type of language, if not even more detail. But I think, you know, increasingly, we may see environmental scientists who are moving in this direction for the bulk of their research, and you know, working at this level that NSF, for example, has called various things like coupled natural and human systems, or the food, energy, water nexus. That kind of system thinking, you know, may come more to the forefront in environmental sciences. But really, I don't know.
No, it's good. This is the speculative play, so it's okay. That's why I'm just, you know, thinking out loud, because it's, you know, I've seen that just in, you know, I think as most people, you know, heard, like, you and I both went to grad school at the same department, but in the, you know, just the time that I was there from approximately 2010 until 20, you know, through 2015, you know, I saw the kind of evolution of different folks' research programs, in particular, kind of the rise of, you know, when I started, there was a lot of work on, you know, there's restoration, particularly in the Chesapeake Bay, because of the close proximity of the department, you know, to that area and research interest. And there was a lot of, you know, and some fundamental work in ecohydrology at the time, as well as a lot of, you know, carbon cycling stuff, which was, you know, kind of my focus at that time. But, you know, over that time period, I did see there was a movement towards, like you said, you know, a couple of human natural systems, and particularly food, water, energy nexus work. Like these really, you know, I don't want to say complex, probably because it's just because I definitely don't understand them and they feel like they go way over my head, but it's just fascinating work that it seemed to, like, it brought in like new skill sets that people were coming in with that were not familiar to me at all. And I saw like kind of the evolution of that, you know, the department at the time. It was kind of fascinating to see that research trend move forward, like moving into stuff like, you know, understanding network analysis, or having to bring in, you know, tools from economics and sociology and epidemiology to kind of understand, you know, the human, like treating, you know, like people and people's decisions as like, you know, differently, like different weighted. That's not something you read in a textbook when you think about, I want to, you know, read about how soil processes work, you know. It's like, occasionally you have something like, oh, agriculture, right? But it's more thinking like specifically like human impacts into the landscape, but also how the landscape and how change affects people. It's just, it's been fascinating to me just in the last few years to see the evolution of the tools that we use and to have to, you know, kind of understand that. I think it's been, you know, really fascinating to see, you know, folks move in that direction and use like the tools of environmental science in these new and novel and interesting ways, you know, particularly, you know, yourself included in that. It's been just fascinating and amazing.
Yeah. And I, like, one of the most exciting parts of this to me is that, that issue of sort of cross-fertilization of tools across the disciplines. I really enjoy thinking about these related areas using the tools of hydrology. You know, we tend to do a lot of model simulations with randomization and things like Monte Carlo simulation. And so I've tried with varying degrees of success to take that type of thinking and apply it to things like environmental justice analyses, you know, which is something that is built into the environmental decision-making process, but enjoys varying degrees of rigor depending on who's conducting the analysis and you know, who's reviewing that analysis. So, I mean, that's really a fun thing for me to think about and interesting. And I like seeing work that crosses the boundaries both conceptually and with tools, you know, bringing the tools of ecology into, you know, into other spaces where the connections might not seem obvious at first, but, you know, if you're intimately familiar with those tools, you may realize that, hey, there's an application here that I think could really make a difference.
So into your work that has kind of, you know, spanned into, you know, working within environmental justice, you know, particularly in relation to like the Atlantic Coast Pipeline work, how did that transition occur for you?
Oh, yeah. So about 5 years ago, an organization called the North Carolina Commission of Indian Affairs, which represents the interests of all of the tribes in the state of North Carolina, recruited me to their newly formed Environmental Justice Committee. We were all together trying to figure out really what that entailed. We were all pretty much new to this concept of environmental justice, even though it's been around for quite some time, and it actually has its roots in North Carolina as a modern social movement. So the EPA defines environmental justice as the fair treatment and meaningful involvement of all people in the environmental decision-making process. And it's meant to be a remedy for the historic and arguably ongoing practice of suppressing or devaluing the voices of certain communities in decision-making. And oftentimes these communities are vulnerable, or they may have few resources and little political power. And these are things that matter in decision-making processes. And so environmental justice is a way to bring equity into the policy space and into the decision-making space. And so one of the first things to come across my plate after I joined this committee was the draft environmental impact statement for the Atlantic Coast Pipeline. And I fully expected to review that with the eyes of a hydrologist and scrutinize things like impacts to wetlands and streams and the such. But I had gotten no further than the executive summary when I saw a statement that it said something like environmental justice populations would not be disproportionately impacted by this project. And one thing you have to understand is that in Eastern North Carolina, where all of this is taking place, you have not only Lumbee people, but other American Indian tribes as well, to the extent that Eastern North Carolina as a region has the largest population of American Indian east of probably Oklahoma. And when you look at the route of this pipeline, it actually cuts through the present day territories of multiple tribes who still live here and call North Carolina home. And so that didn't ring true to me, that statement about no disproportionate impacts on American Indian or other communities that have been historically left out of the decision space. And for me, it was as simple as flipping back to the appendices of this environmental impact statement and finding the data tables that were used to inform that conclusion, and running a few simple calculations and finding that that statement was untrue. And so what I subsequently learned is that there was a overly complicated demographic test that those raw data had been pushed through in order to come up with the conclusion that these communities weren't being disproportionately impacted. And so my work since then, the technical side of my work has focused on deconstructing that particular test and trying to show in a variety of different ways how it really misses the mark when it comes to detecting the presence of certain communities at levels that stand out above a background level to which they're being compared. I would say like that technical work is probably the simpler part of what I've done over the past couple of years, and that's to really raise awareness in the public space about what environmental justice is and what the lay of the land is today when we talk about the extent to which environmental justice and related policy concepts are taken seriously in the decision-making space. And so that has really shifted the tenor of my work over the past 2 or 2.5 years into more of a public outreach and education about not only environmental justice, but the related concept of tribal consultation, which is another federal policy concept that has a fraught history. So, you know, that's involved a lot of learning for me. Fortunately, all of this came right at the beginning of a sabbatical. So my sabbatical really turned into a learning experience about environmental policy and environmental decision making. And it afforded me time to invest deeply in meetings with leaders in tribal governments and state governments, and even talking with folks who work in federal agencies who are responsible for this type of thing. So, you know, I've kind of had to change part of my identity as a scientist. You know, you talked early on about the work that I did in Montana and all of this modeling with coupled carbon and water cycles. And we still do that work in my lab, but I guess I never realized until recently just how much time and effort it takes to do you know, public-facing science, trying to articulate scientific and related policy concepts to people, especially people who are in power. So that's it's a heavy task, and you know, there are probably people who are better at it or more effective at it than I am, and I'd happily partner with some of those people. But I have this really newfound respect for science communication and just the process of communication in general.
I also want to tell you, because I haven't had a chance to talk to you in person in a while, I guess since like we were in San Francisco last, but the article that you had in Environmental History, the one on, you know, Lumbee people and the history of water, was one, I really like it. It was an awesome article, but it's been, it very rarely do I see somebody who I know's, you know, writing and work in like one aspect in like a completely different realm of academia, like, you know, writing from that historical perspective. So I just wanted to tell you, like, great piece. I'm going to link to a bunch of stuff on the website, but you know, that work, like seeing you bring like kind of that scientific perspective, you know, with the historical perspective as well. And, you know, it's a really great work that also includes, like you mentioned, that, you know, hydrograph that goes back to 1929 as well, the Lumber River. But yeah, it's, I don't know, like, I think it's really cool to me, like on the outside, like seeing somebody's, you know, research branch into all these different ways. And I don't know, it's just, it's kind of fascinating.
It's all, you know, this work is connected. Is what I found is, you know, if you want to do climate related research and do it in a way that is impactful for a community, you have to understand any relevant historical context for that community. And what I found was that, you know, there is a lot of excellent history that's been written and published both by and about Lumbee people. It wasn't there from the angle that I needed it to be presented and scrutinized. And so, yeah, instead of waiting around for somebody else to do it, I thought that would be a good space for me to enter into, and maybe a good testing ground for crossover into the humanities. But I will say I had a lot of help from scholars in the humanities, people like Melinda Maynard Lowry, who's probably the preeminent Lumbee historian, gave me a lot of valuable input. And you know, the editor was very gracious in kind of walking me through the process of you know, doing a manuscript in the humanities is very different from doing a manuscript in the sciences. So yeah, I had fun with it, but there's also a lot of guidance that I was able to get from scholars in that area. And I will add, I think this is the first time I will announce it publicly, but I'm now under contract with UNC Press to write a book on Native environmental science that focuses on the Lumbee River and the people of that region. So I'm working on that this summer, and we'll be working on it over the next year and a half or so.
Oh wow, that's awesome. Congratulations.
Thanks.
That'll be really exciting. I'm very excited about that. So I have before I want to get your closing thoughts on anything, but thinking about, people who want to branch out maybe, from their own research, building a fundamental towards, working either with it, particularly through environmental justice or even through just, wanting to work more in these kind of coupled systems. Do you have any thoughts or advice for people who want to move their research more towards that way?
Oh man. Make sure it's what you want to do. Because we get to a, I'll speak for myself. I felt like I found a point in the hydrologic sciences where I felt pretty comfortable. I felt like I was recognized for the expertise that I had, and I knew what I was I knew what I was about, but the, this process of working in different disciplines, there is a obviously there's a steep learning curve, right? Because we have experts in all these different disciplines, and I don't claim to be a policy expert or a history expert, but to bring yourself up to the bar of being able to communicate in scholarly ways in those fields is a very humbling experience. So be prepared to invest that time in crossing over if that's really something that you want to do. And I don't know if I'm a good or a bad or a successful model for that at all. So take that advice for what it's worth. But there's a big investment in doing that. So like make sure it's something that you want to do and that you're invested in before you decide to do that. Okay. Maybe somebody will come in and add on to that and give a counterpoint or elaborate. But that's been my experience over the past couple of years. I really, there have been times I felt like a really big dummy because I don't know what's going on conceptually in these areas, and I don't know.
That makes me feel a lot better about life in general, though, hearing you say that.
But you know what? It's the best. I guess the best part about it is we often use we often say like, oh, we're lifelong learners in academia, and it's all about learning and discovery and new knowledge. And it is always about that for the research that we do. I would say it's especially like that crossing over and doing major interdisciplinary work.
It's always good to hear accomplished people telling you that kind of thing. It's like, okay, good. Maybe there's still hope for me yet. Brian, I really appreciate it. Do you have any closing thoughts or anything we didn't get to that you wanted to throw in there?
I don't know. I will say I'm putting all this hemming and hawing in here with the expectation that you'll edit all that out. Oh no.
I will. I
I
will.
want to say I want to say something about how I guess how much hope and enthusiasm that I have about about the next couple of generations now that I see coming up in the environmental sciences. So I guess what I'll say is that I have a lot of hope and enthusiasm about the next couple of generations that I'm interacting with in the environmental sciences. We've got a generation of early career PhDs who are out doing really extraordinary work. They're working on topics that I'm really excited about. Your work with vegetation structure using LIDAR, that is super exciting, and the kinds of things that you are doing now were beyond the wildest dreams technologically and conceptually of people like myself who were really just looking at the infancy of LIDAR back in our day. So I'm really excited about that kind of work. But then the students today, our current generation of grad students, you know, are being exposed to, it was now becoming sort of textbook knowledge in these areas. And so, you know, if your generation is able to do all of this really extraordinary work based on the textbooks that, you know, that the previous generations had left behind for you, I'm really thrilled to see what today's students are going to be accomplishing in the next, you know, 5 to 10 years. I'm really optimistic, you know, about where we're going as a field. And I am comfortable now saying the field of environmental sciences, because I believe that more and more of us are reaching more broadly than just hydrology and ecology or whatever ology we're all about. And, you know, we all recognize the interconnectedness of these earth systems, even if we're not, you know, if we're not hands-on modeling or measuring in one system or another. But so I would say overall, I'm just really enthusiastic and excited, and I love being an environmental scientist.
Ryan, thank you so much for coming on, and please, if you would consider it, come back once the book is out, because we'd love to, you know, talk back about that if you'd like to.
Yeah.
So you're always welcome. Everyone, you can, you know, I'll put up a lot of information in the show notes on the website so you guys can check stuff out. You can also find Ryan on Twitter, at Water Potential. I want to take undue credit for trying to talk Ryan into joining Twitter like multiple years ago, and then he finally did.
Yes, you are the reason I'm on Twitter. I'm going to give you all the props for that. So thank you for that.
The thing is that, like, I jokingly tried to get you into it, and then you did it, and then just absolutely crushed the freaking platform and, like, the way, and, like, nobody else. So please follow Ryan at Water Potential, and it'll make you a better person for following him, as you'll learn something that'll help you improve the world around you and yourself. Ryan, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Jeff. I'm really glad to be here. I look forward to talking to you again soon.
Absolutely.
That's right, you're bold enough to lie.